Chapter 2. The Stages of Initiation. The following information forms part of a spiritual training whose name and essential nature will become clear to anyone who makes use of it in the right way. It concerns the three stages by which the school of spiritual life leads to a certain degree of initiation. But only those explanations that may be made public will be found here. They are indications derived from a much deeper, more intimate teaching. In the esoteric school from which these communications are drawn, the student follows a definite course of instruction. Specific tasks and exercises are used there to bring the human soul into a conscious relationship with the spiritual world. These more esoteric practices compare with those presented here as an instruction given in a rigorously disciplined higher school or college compares with what is taught incidentally as a preparation in a lower school. Yet the sincere and unwavering pursuit of what is intimated here nevertheless leads to real esoteric training. Impatient experimentation without sincerity and persistence, however, will get us nowhere. We can succeed in esoteric study only when the indications given in the previous chapter are observed and made the foundation of further work. Three stages of initiation are described in the tradition from which this schooling derives: preparation, illumination, and initiation. These three stages do not follow each other so rigidly that it is absolutely necessary to complete one stage fully before going on to the next. A person may receive illumination and even initiation in relation to some things while remaining at a stage of preparation in relation to others. Nevertheless, a student must spend a certain amount of time in preparation before the stage of illumination can begin, and only after illumination has taken place, at least regarding certain things, can initiation begin. For simplicity's sake, however, the description that follows will discuss the three stages in sequence. Preparation. The stage of preparation consists in a quite definite method of cultivating our lives of feeling and thinking. Just as natural forces equip the physical body with organs fashioned from unstructured living matter, so the care and cultivation of our lives of feeling and thinking endow our soul and spiritual bodies with higher senses and organs of activity. The first step is to direct the soul's attention towards certain processes in the world around us. These processes are life, as it buds, grows, and flourishes. And on the other hand, all phenomena connected with withering, fading, and dying away. Wherever we turn our eyes, these two processes are present together. By their nature, they always evoke feelings and thoughts in us. Normally, however, we do not give ourselves sufficiently to these feelings and thoughts. We rush from one sense impression to the next. Now, however, we must consciously and intensively focus our full attention on them. Whenever we perceive a quite definite form of blossoming and flourishing, we must banish all else from our souls and for a short time dwell on this one impression alone. As we do so, we will soon realize that a feeling that previously only flitted through our souls has now grown and become strong and filled with energy. We must let this feeling quietly echo within us. We must become inwardly completely still. Cutting ourselves off from the rest of the world around us, we must attend only to what the soul has to tell us about the facts of blossoming and flourishing. But attending to our souls in this way should not lead us to believe that we shall advance far on the path if we blunt our senses to the world. First, we must look at things as actively and precisely as possible. Only thereafter should we devote ourselves to the feelings coming to life in our souls and the thoughts arising there. It is essential that we give our attention to both feelings and thoughts as they arise in complete inner equilibrium. If we find the necessary inner peace, surrendering ourselves to what comes to life in our souls, then after a certain time we will experience the following. We will notice rising up within us new kinds of feelings and thoughts that we never knew before. The more often we focus our attention first on something growing and flourishing, and then on something withering and dying away, the more lively and active these feelings will become. Eventually, just as the eyes and ears of our physical organism are formed by natural forces out of inanimate matter, so organs of clairvoyant seeing are formed out of the feelings and thoughts that arise in relation to growing and flourishing, withering and dying. If we cultivate our feeling life in this way, we will find that a specific form of feeling is attached to processes of growing and becoming, while quite another is attached to those of withering and dying. These forms of feeling may be described, but only approximately. Each student may obtain a complete idea of them, however, by going through the inner experience. Whoever repeatedly directs his or her attention to processes of becoming, flourishing, and blossoming will feel something faintly resembling the sensation we experience as we watch the sun rise. Processes of withering and dying, on the other hand, will produce an experience that may be compared with what we feel as we watch the slow rise of the moon on the horizon. Cultivated appropriately and trained in ever livelier and more active fashion, these two types of feeling become forces that can lead to the most significant spiritual effects. Deliberately, regularly, and repeatedly surrendering to such feelings, we find a new world opening before us. The soul world, or so-called astral plane, begins to dawn. Growth and decay are now no longer merely facts evoking vague impressions, as they were before. Instead, they form definite spiritual lines and figures we had no inkling of before. What is more, these lines and figures change their forms with the phenomena. A blossoming flower conjures up a particular line before our souls, while a growing animal or a dying tree gives rise to other lines. In this way, the soul world spreads out before us. These lines and figures are not arbitrary. Two students at the same level of development will see the same lines and figures associated with the same processes. Just as two healthy people with good eyes both see a round table as round, and neither sees it as rectangular, so in the presence of a flower, two souls both see the same spiritual form arising. Just as biologists customarily describe and classify plants and animals according to their forms, which are the same for every observer, so experts in the spiritual science describe and characterize the spiritual forms of the processes of growth and death, and distinguish various species and types among them. Once we have advanced to the point where we can see the spiritual forms of what appears physically visible to our outer eyes, then we are not far from the stage of seeing things that have no physical existence at all. Such things, of course, remain completely hidden or occult to one who has received no esoteric training. Here, it must be emphasized that the spiritual researchers should not lose themselves in reflection upon what this or that might mean. Mental activity of this kind will only lead us astray. We should look out at the world with healthy, alert senses and a keen power of observation, and then give ourselves over to our feelings. We should not try to determine what things mean with a speculative mind, but should let things themselves tell us their meaning. Another important point is what esoteric science calls orientation in the higher worlds. We achieve such an orientation when we have filled ourselves completely with the consciousness that feelings and thoughts are actual facts, just as real as tables and chairs are in the physical sensory world. In the worlds of soul and thought, feelings and thoughts affect one another just as we cannot believe that entertaining a wrong thought can have as devastating an effect on the other thoughts that animate our thought world as a bullet shot blindly from a rifle has on things it hits in the physical world. Thus, although we might never allow ourselves to engage in visible actions that we consider meaningless, we nonetheless do not shrink from entertaining wrong thoughts or feelings because these do not seem to us to be dangerous to the rest of the world. To move forward on the path to higher knowledge and advance in spiritual science, we must therefore pay as careful attention to our thoughts and feelings as we do to our movements in the physical world. For instance, we do not usually try to go straight through a wall, but direct our steps around it. That is, we comply with the laws of the physical world. The world of feelings and thoughts likewise has its own laws, but they do not force themselves upon us from the outside. Rather, they must flow out of the life of the soul. For this to occur, we must never allow ourselves false thoughts and feelings. Random musings, playful daydreams, the arbitrary ebb and flow of feelings, all these must be banished from the soul. We need not fear that this will make us unfeeling. On the contrary, we will find that only when we regulate our inner life in this way do we become truly rich in feelings and creative in genuine imagination. Important feelings and fruitful thoughts will then take the place of petty indulgence in the emotions and the playful association of ideas. These, in turn, will help us to orient ourselves in the spiritual world, thereby allowing us to enter into a right relationship with the things in it. And this, too, has a definite, noticeable effect. Just as we find our way as physical beings among things of the physical world, so now our path leads us through the phenomena of growing and dying away, as we come to know these things in the manner described above. We follow the processes of growing and flourishing, decaying and dying, just as our own and the world's development require. The students of occult knowledge must also direct their attention to the world of sounds. Here we must distinguish between sounds produced by so-called inanimate objects, such as a falling object, a bell, or a musical instrument, and those coming from living beings. If we hear a bell, we perceive the sound and associate it with a pleasant feeling. The scream of an animal, on the other hand, not only evokes an emotional association, but also reveals the animal's inner experience, its pleasure or its pain. In esoteric training, we focus on the second type of sound, concentrating our whole attention on the fact that the sound communicates something that lies outside our own souls. We must immerse ourselves in this otherness, inwardly uniting our feelings with the pain or pleasure expressed by the sound. To do this, we must disregard what the sound is for us, whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, agreeable or disagreeable. Our soul must be filled only with what is happening in the being from whom the sound comes. If we practice this exercise systematically and deliberately, we will acquire, as we do so, the faculty of merging, as it were, with the being that made the sound. A musically sensitive person will naturally find this particular exercise for the cultivation of the soul life easier than one who is unmusical. But no one should think that a musical ear is a substitute for systematically doing the exercise. As occult students, our goal is to learn to feel toward the whole of nature in this way. As we learn to do so, a new faculty takes root in the world of feeling and thought. All of nature begins to whisper its secrets to us through its sounds. Sounds that were previously incomprehensible to our soul now become the meaningful language of nature. Where we had heard only noise in the sounds produced by inanimate objects, we now learn a new language of the soul. As this cultivation of our feelings continues, we become aware that we can hear things we never conceived of before. Indeed, we begin to hear with our souls. Something must be added to this practice before the highest point in this region of soul experience can be attained. Particularly important as we develop as occult pupils is that we also work on the way we listen to other people when they speak. On the path to higher knowledge, this listening skill is extremely important. We must become accustomed to listening in such a way that we quiet our own inner life completely when we listen. For example, when someone expresses an opinion and another listens, Agreement or disagreement usually stirs immediately within the listener. Often, in such a situation, we feel compelled to express our own opinion at once, especially if we disagree. However, on the path to higher knowledge, we must learn to silence any agreement or disagreement with the opinions we hear. Naturally, this does not mean that we should suddenly change our way of life and strive to achieve this complete inner silence all the time. We must start with isolated instances that we choose intentionally. Then, quite slowly and gradually, as if by itself, this new way of listening will become a habit. In spiritual research, we practice this new way of listening in a systematic way. As students, we should feel it our duty to set aside, as an exercise, certain times when we listen to the most contrary opinions, completely silencing within us all agreement and especially all negative judgments. Not only must we silence our intellectual judgment, but also any feelings of disapproval, rejection, or even agreement. Above all, we must observe ourselves carefully to ensure that such feelings, even though absent from the surface of the soul, are not present in its innermost depths. For example, we must learn to listen to the remarks of those who are in some way inferior to us, suppressing every feeling of superiority or knowing better. Listening to children in this way is especially useful, and even the wisest of us can learn a great deal from them. These exercises teach us to listen selflessly to the words of others, completely excluding our own personality, opinions, and feelings. Once we are practiced in listening in this way without criticism, then gradually, even when the most contradictory views and illogical statements are aired before us, we begin to learn how to unite ourselves with the being of the other person and fully enter into it. We begin to hear through the words into the other person's soul. As we consistently practice this new habit, sound becomes the medium through which we can perceive soul and spirit. This practice requires the strictest self-discipline, but it also leads to a lofty goal. For when the exercise is combined with those given above in connection with sounds in nature, then a new sense of hearing comes to life in the soul. The soul becomes capable of hearing words from the spiritual world that are not expressed in outer tones and cannot be heard by physical ears. Perception of the inner word awakens. Truths are gradually revealed to us out of the spiritual world. We hear ourselves spoken to spiritually. All higher truths are attained only through such inward prompting. Whatever we hear from the lips of true spiritual researchers is only what they have brought into experience in this way. This does not mean that it is unnecessary to study esoteric literature before we ourselves have become able to hear this inner word. On the contrary, reading such writings and listening to teachings of esoteric researchers are themselves a means of achieving knowledge for ourselves. Indeed, every statement of spiritual science that we hear is intended to guide the mind in the direction it must take if the soul is to experience any true progress. Therefore, the exercises described here should be accompanied by the intensive study of what researchers in spiritual science bring into the world. Such study is part of a preparatory work in all schools of esoteric training. In fact, all the other methods taken together will not get us anywhere if we do not also absorb the teachings of esoteric researchers. These teachings are drawn forth from the living inner word, from living inspiration, and therefore they themselves are spiritually alive. They are not just words, they are living forces. And as we follow the words of one experienced in esoteric knowledge or read a book based on true inner experience, forces are at work in our souls that make us seers, clairvoyants, just as the forces of nature have shaped our eyes and ears out of living matter. Illumination. The stage of illumination starts from very simple processes. Here too, as in the stage of preparation, It is a matter of developing and awakening certain feelings and thoughts latent in every one of us. Anyone who focuses on these simple processes with persistence, rigor, and complete patience will be led to a perception of the inner manifestations of light. We begin by examining different natural objects in a particular way. For example, a crystal, a plant, and an animal. First, we try to direct our whole attention to comparing a stone and an animal. The thoughts that we form to make this comparison must pass through the soul, accompanied by lively feelings. No other thoughts or feelings must be allowed to intrude or disturb our intense, attention-filled observation. We should say to ourselves, the stone has a form. The animal also has a form. The stone stays peacefully in its place. The animal changes its place. It is instinct or desire that moves the animal to change its place. Instincts are also served by the animal's form. Its organs and limbs are shaped by these instincts. Stones, on the other hand, are not shaped by desires, but rather by a force that is without desire. As we immerse ourselves intensely in these thoughts, observing stone and animal with close attention, two very different kinds of feeling come to life in the soul. One kind streams into the soul from the stone, another from the animal. Although this exercise will probably not succeed in the beginning, gradually, if we practice with real patience, the two feelings will eventually appear. We need only practice the exercise over and over again. At first, the feelings persist only as long as the observation lasts. Later, they continue to work on after the exercise is over. Eventually, they become something that remains alive in our souls. At that point, we need only to reflect for stone and animal feelings to arise again, even without the contemplation of an external object. Out of these feelings and the thoughts accompanying them, organs of clairvoyance are formed. If we add plants to our observations, we notice that the feeling streaming from a plant, both in its nature and intensity, lies midway between what streams from a stone and what streams from an animal. The organs built up in this way are spiritual eyes. They gradually allow us to see soul and spiritual colors. But as long as we have not made our own what was previously described as the path or stage of preparation, the lines and figures of the spiritual world remain dark. Through the process of illumination, they become light. Here again, it must be noted that the words used, such as dark and light, as well as other expressions, are only approximations of what is meant. Our ordinary languages were created for physical relationships. If we use ordinary language, as we must, only approximations of spiritual phenomena are possible. Thus, occult science describes what clairvoyant organs perceive as flowing from stones as blue or blue-red, while what flows from animals is described as red or red-yellow. In fact, the colors seen are spiritual colors. The color streaming from plants is green, gradually fading to a light, etheric rose pink. Plants are actually the only natural beings whose constitution in the higher worlds resembles to some extent their constitution in the physical world. This is not the case with stones or animals. Obviously, the previously mentioned colors represent only the main tones of the mineral, animal, and plant kingdoms. In reality, all possible intermediary hues exist. Each stone, plant, and animal has its own particular color nuance. To this picture must be added the beings of the higher worlds that never incarnate physically. Their colors can be magnificent, but sometimes they are horrible. On the whole, the range of color in the higher worlds is immeasurably greater than in the physical world. Once we achieve the capacity of seeing with spiritual eyes, we sooner or later meet the higher beings previously mentioned, as well as sometimes also those beings lower than we who never enter our physical reality. Having brought our practice to the point described here, paths to many worlds lie open before us. But no one is advised to proceed further without paying careful attention to what is said or communicated by spiritual researchers. In fact, even with regard to what has already been said, it is always best to heed experienced guidance. Naturally, if we have the strength and persistence to reach these elementary levels of illumination, we will certainly seek and find the right kind of direction. One precaution, at all events, is essential, and whoever is unwilling to adopt it had better not proceed in occult science at all. As esoteric students, we must not lose any of our human qualities, but must remain noble-minded, good people, sensitive to all aspects of physical reality. In fact, throughout the course of our esoteric training, we must continuously increase our moral strength, inner integrity, and faculty of observation. During the basic exercises, for example, we must seek to enlarge not only our compassion for the human and animal worlds, but also our sense for the beauty of nature. If we do not bear this in mind, then both these feelings and our aesthetic sense will be dulled by the exercises. Our heart will become hard, our senses blunted. Clearly, this would have dangerous consequences. What happens in the stage of illumination after we have practiced the stone, plant, and animal exercises, and have risen to a consideration of the human being, and how, after illumination, the soul unites with the spiritual world under all circumstances, and so is led to initiation, all this the next sections will describe, insofar as it is possible to do so. Many people today seek a path to occult or esoteric science. Their quest takes various forms. Many dangerous and even illicit practices are tried. Therefore, those who believe that they know something of the truth in these matters should give others the opportunity to learn something about esoteric training. This book presents such an opportunity, nothing more. Something of the truth must be made known to prevent error from causing great harm. No harm will come to anyone on this path, provided he or she does not seek to force results. Just one thing must be borne in mind. We should not spend more time and energy on these exercises than is in keeping with our position and duties in life. Pursuing a path of esoteric training should never lead to any sudden change in one's life situation. If we want real results, we must have patience. We must be able to stop the exercises after just a few minutes and continue with our daily work as usual. We must not let thoughts of our exercises mingle with our work. Whoever has not learned to wait, in the noblest and best sense of the word, is unsuited to esoteric work and will never achieve results of any real value. Controlling our thoughts and feelings. As we seek esoteric knowledge on the path previously described, one thought can give us strength in all our efforts. We must never forget that we may already have advanced quite far, even though this progress has not manifested in ways we might expect. If we do not remember this, we can easily lose heart and give up our efforts completely. In the beginning, the forces and capacities that we must develop are extremely delicate. Their nature is quite other than we previously imagined. Until now, we have been used to dealing only with the physical world. The realms of soul and spirit had escaped our vision and our grasp. Thus, it is not surprising that we do not notice immediately that forces of soul and spirit are beginning to develop in us. There is the possibility of error here for anyone who undertakes an esoteric path while remaining ignorant of the experiences gathered by accomplished spiritual researchers. Such spiritual researchers can see our progress long before we are aware of it. They know that delicate spiritual eyes can develop before we are aware of them. Indeed, the instructions of researchers are, for the most part, designed to keep us from losing our confidence, patience, and perseverance at a time when we cannot yet see our progress for ourselves. Esoteric teachers cannot give us anything that is not already present, although concealed within us. They can only guide us in the development of our own dormant capacities. Nevertheless, what they communicate out of their experience will be a help to us when we seek to struggle from the darkness into the light. Many people abandon the path to occult knowledge soon after embarking upon it because they do not notice any immediate progress. Students often mistake their first perceptible higher experiences for illusions when these do not correspond with what they had expected. Such students lose courage because they consider their first experiences worthless or because these experiences seemed insignificant and unlikely to lead to anything more valuable in the foreseeable future. Courage and self-confidence are two beacons that should never be extinguished on the path to higher knowledge. No one who cannot patiently repeat an exercise that has failed, to all appearances, countless times before, will travel far on this path. Long before we have a clear perception of our progress, we have a vague feeling that we are on the right track. This feeling should be cultivated and nurtured, for it can become a reliable guide. Above all, we must eradicate the belief that only bizarre and mysterious practices lead to higher knowledge. We should be clear that development begins with the feelings and thoughts we live with all the time, but that these feelings and thoughts must be given a new, unaccustomed direction. We must say to ourselves, "Within my own feelings and thoughts, the highest mysteries lie concealed, but until now I have not perceived them." In the final analysis, everything is based on the simple fact that, though we carry body, soul, and spirit about with us, we are conscious only of the body. The esoteric student must become as conscious of the soul and spirit as the ordinary person is of his or her body. It all comes down to giving our feelings and thoughts the right direction. Only then can we gain the ability to see what ordinarily remains invisible. One of the ways of achieving this will be given here. Once again, it is a simple exercise, like almost everything that has been presented so far. Yet the effects of this exercise, if carried out with perseverance, devotion, and the necessary inner mood, will be far-reaching. We place before us a small seed from a plant. Starting with this insignificant thing, the point will be to think the right thoughts intensively, and by means of these thoughts to develop certain feelings. First, we must establish what we are really seeing with our eyes. We describe to ourselves the form, color, and other properties of the seed. Then we ponder the thought, "This seed, if planted in the ground, will grow into a complex plant." We visualize the plant. We make it present to and in us. We build it up in imagination, and then we think, "What I now visualize in my imagination, forces of earth and light will later in reality draw forth from this small seed. But if this were an artificial seed, an artificial copy so perfect that my eyes could not distinguish it from a real seed, then no forces of earth and light would ever be able to draw forth such a plant from it." If we can clearly form this thought and bring it to life within us, then we will be able to form the next thought easily and with the right feeling. Within the seed already lies concealed what, as the force of the whole plant, later grows out of it. The artificial copy of the seed has no such force. Yet to my eyes, both seeds look the same. Therefore, the real seed contains something invisible that is absent in the copy. Thoughts and feelings should now focus on this invisible reality. We must imagine that this invisible force or reality will, in the course of time, change into the visible plant, whose color and form we will be able to see before us. We should hold the thought, "The invisible will become visible. If I were unable to think, then what later becomes visible could not announce itself to me now." It is important to emphasize that whatever we think, we must also feel with intensity. Meditative thoughts need to be experienced calmly and peacefully. No other thoughts should distract us. Time should be allowed for both the thought and the feeling united with it to penetrate the soul. If this is done in the right way, then after a time, perhaps only after many unsuccessful attempts, we become conscious of a new force within us. This creates a new perception. The seed seems to be enclosed in a small cloud of light. In a sensory, spiritual way, we sense it as a kind of flame. At its center, we experience a sensation similar to the impression made by the color purple. At its edges, a sensation similar to the color blue. What we could not see before now becomes apparent to us, created by the force of the thoughts and feelings that we have awakened within us. The plant, which is still physically invisible and will not become visible until later, is revealed to us in a spiritually visible manner. Understandably, some people consider all this mere illusion. Many will say, "I do not want to have anything to do with such hallucinations and visions." Some will fall away and abandon the path. What it comes down to is this: fantasy and spiritual reality must not be confused in this complex matter of inner development. We must have the courage to push forward and not become faint-hearted and fearful. On the other hand, we must always cultivate a healthy sense for the distinction between truth and illusion. We should never lose conscious self-control during the exercises. Our thinking must be as certain and reliable in carrying out the exercises as it is when we apply it to the things and processes of everyday life. We must remain clear-headed and down-to-earth at all times. It would be very bad indeed if we fell into daydreaming. Our reasoning must be perfectly lucid, even sober, at all times. The greatest mistake would be to lose our equilibrium through such exercises and thus be hindered from forming as sound and sensible opinions in everyday life as we did before. Therefore, we should examine ourselves repeatedly to ensure that we have not lost our balance and that we still remain the same within the relationships of our daily lives as we were before we started the exercises. Steady inner calm and a clear mind for all things, these must be preserved. Above all, we must take care not to indulge each passing reverie or give ourselves up to every possible different kind of exercise. The directions for thinking given here have been tested and practiced in occult schools from the most ancient times. Only such time-tested methods are presented here. To use other methods, either ones that we have created ourselves or those we have read or heard about, will lead inevitably to a path of error and boundless fantasy. A further exercise connected to the seed meditation is the following. We place before us a mature plant. First, we immerse ourselves in the thought, "A time will come when this plant will wither and decay. Everything I see now will then no longer exist. But the plant will have produced seeds, and these will become new plants. Thus, once again, I become aware that something I cannot see lies hidden in what I can see." We saturate ourselves with the thought, "The plant form with all its colors will soon no longer be there. But the knowledge that the plant produces seeds teaches me that it will not disappear into nothingness. I cannot see what preserves the plant from disappearance any more than I could see the future plant in the seed. Therefore, it follows that there is something in the plant, too, that I cannot see with my eyes. But if I let this thought live in me, and the appropriate feeling unites with it, then after a time, new force will grow in my soul and become a new perception. A kind of spiritual flame form will then grow out of the plant. Of course, this flame will be correspondingly larger than the one described in the case of the seed. It will be felt as green-blue at its center and as yellow-red at its periphery. Again, it must be strongly emphasized that we do not see what are here called colors in the same way that we see colors with our physical eyes. Rather, through spiritual perception, we experience something similar to the impression made by physical colors. To perceive blue spiritually is to feel or sense an impression similar to the one we feel when our physical eyes dwell on the color blue. We must remember this if we wish to ascend gradually to true spiritual perception. If we do not, we will expect us in the worst way. Once we have reached the point of such spiritual seeing, we have already achieved much. Things now reveal to us not only their present being, but also their arising and passing away. We begin to see the spirit, of which our physical eyes know nothing, everywhere. We have begun to approach the mystery of birth and death with our own intuitive vision. As far as our physical senses are concerned, an entity comes into being with birth and passes away with death. But this is only because the outer senses cannot perceive the hidden spirit. For the spirit, birth and death are merely transformations, just as the burgeoning of a bud into a blossom is a transformation occurring before our physical eyes. To come to know this firsthand through our own spiritual vision, we must first awaken spiritual senses for it in the way indicated here. Those who have had some soul or psychic experience of the supersensible worlds might object that there are shorter and simpler ways to attain spiritual perception. Indeed, it cannot be disputed that some people come to know the phenomena of birth and death through personal vision without undertaking the exercises described here. Some people have considerable psychic gifts, which require only slight stimulation in order to be developed further. But such people are exceptional. The path described here is safer and more generally effective. A person may achieve some knowledge of chemistry in unusual ways, but if we wish to become real chemists, we must follow the more certain and generally accepted path. We would be committing a serious error with far-reaching consequences if we believed that we could reach our objective more easily by dispensing with the actual object of our meditation and simply forming a mental picture of the seed or plant that we then held in our imaginations. This path may indeed also lead us to results, but it is not as sure and proven as the one presented in this book. For the perceptions we attain in this way often turn out to be delusions of fantasy, and we must then wait for these to be transformed into genuine spiritual vision. The point of these exercises is not that we arbitrarily create perceptions for ourselves, but that reality creates them in us. The truth must well up from the depths of our own souls, but the ordinary I should not be the magician who conjures up the truth. The beings whose spiritual truth I seek to behold must conjure their own truth. When, by practicing such exercises, we have discovered in ourselves the first rudiments of spiritual perception, we can then go on to contemplate our fellow human beings. We begin by selecting some simple phenomena connected with human life. But before we take this step, we must work sincerely and seriously on the integrity of our moral character. We must remove all thoughts of ever using the knowledge gained in this way for our own self-interest. We must firmly decide never to use for evil ends any power we might gain over other people.